This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with a journalist who spent 10 years preparing to retrace her Armenian grandfather's trek through the Syrian desert while he escaped the Armenian genocide.
Hitler famously said, "Kill without pity or mercy." Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians? Well, we do on Law and Disorder.
We'll talk about partisan gerrymandering and an important case in Wisconsin that may be headed all the way to the Supreme Court.
We speak with the main plaintiff, retired law professor Bill Whitford, in a case which, if won at the Supreme Court, could bring us a new measure of democracy in this country.
We'll be joined by two anti-apartheid activists who have just returned from a conference on Israel held in Cork, Ireland.
Apartheid is a crime against humanity. Listen in for what they've judged Israel to be doing.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. April 24th marks the 101st anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Until recently, most Americans had never heard of the genocide, and rarely, if ever, hear the individual stories of those who survived atrocities at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. Journalist Dawn McKean came to learn the personal account of her grandfather, Stepan Miskjian, after reading notebooks that he had kept a century ago, chronicling his story. She then embarked on a multi-year journey, using her research skills to scour newspapers and archives around the globe, to recreate and then actually retrace his steps taken 100 years earlier through Turkey and Syria. She has written an eye-opening book, The 100-Year Walk, An Armenian Odyssey. It recounts not only her grandfather's experience, but those of the approximately 1.5 million Armenians who were tortured and killed in the genocide that began in 1915. As many Armenian genocide survivors did, Don's grandfather escaped just before the members of his caravan were massacred by disguising himself as an Arab. Joining us today to share many other remarkable details of her grandfather's journey, as well as her own experience recreating what he went through, is Dawn McKean. Dawn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Dawn, what did it feel like when you first read your grandfather's journals? Did you have any idea before that of the kinds of atrocities that he saw?
I grew up with this story about how my grandfather survived the Armenian Genocide. Ever since I can remember, my mother has been telling me these stories of how my grandfather had crossed the desert, and he had been so thirsty, he had no water, no food. He had 2 cups of water for the desert crossing for 6 days, and so he had to drink his own urine to survive. And as a child listening to that, I couldn't comprehend it. Like, why did my grandfather do this? And then I would hear snippets of stories, but I thought of him as a sad man and really didn't understand much more than that. Finally, when I was living in New York as an adult, someone had translated my grandfather's journals into English from Armenian, and I could finally read his account, and I could not believe what he had endured. And since he died when I was a child, it was almost like reading someone else's, like a Holocaust memoir or a book that I was assigned in college. Or I didn't really know him, so I was reading about this protagonist who was just struggling to survive. And then it would hit me that this was my own grandfather, and that if he didn't get out of this situation, that our whole family line wouldn't exist. So it was an incredibly powerful moment for me and changed the course of my life.
Now, before we get into the research and your recreation of where he went, tell us, what kinds of details were recorded in the journals? Were they very specific? And how were they helpful as you decided to really recreate his steps?
They were extremely detailed. His journals included everything from the amount of change in his pocket at any time, the kind of food he was able to kind of find during the genocide. It included the names of other people in his caravan and what villages they were from. And so as a reporter going through his account, it was extremely helpful because he left all these clues and, you know, solid bits of information that I could follow up on. When I went in, I knew that the genocide happened. I wasn't going into the story saying, did this happen, did this not? I knew that it happened. But I didn't know how reliable my grandfather was as a narrator, you know, how accurate was his account. And what I found over the next decade of researching, he was extremely accurate. Almost everything kind of dovetailed with other research that I found of other people's accounts who were with him during the genocide.
Don, how did your grandfather escape? And what did he do when he first got to Syria and then the United States?
Sure. He escaped about seven times. He constantly reinvented himself to kind of blend into the surroundings. As a child, he lost his father at a very young age, so he had to help support his family. He dropped out of school. So I think that those kind of survival skills from a very young age helped him survive later on. In 1916, he survived the massacre of thousands of people in what's now eastern Syria. Almost his whole caravan was slaughtered. And the night before it happened, he managed to escape. He crawled past the guards. He pretended that he had to relieve himself and then crawled down onto his hands and knees and kind of moved into the desert night. And then he had a six-day crossing of the desert to get to the Euphrates, and he was alone. He just summoned such incredible strength inside, you know, just both emotional. He was pushed to both his physical and emotional limits, where he finally made it to the Euphrates, and then after that heard about this powerful sheikh in the area and approached him. But first, my grandfather disguised himself. He disguised himself as a local Arab in the area and approached this sheikh. My grandfather, whose name was Stepan, he introduced himself as Mustafa. And the sheikh wasn't fooled by my grandfather's disguise, and he said, "Tell me your real name." The sheikh knew that my grandfather was one of the Armenians in the area, and at the time, the Ottoman government had branded the Armenians as extremely dangerous people. And the sheikh took my grandfather in anyway and treated him like a son and helped save his life.
Don, you researched and prepared for this for one decade. Was this an immediate or an evolving decision to go into that depth of research and then actually walk through the steps that he walked through Turkey and the Syrian desert? And were your parents supportive of this?
Well, my mother always wanted me to tell her father's story, but I don't think she quite understood the lengths that I would go to when I originally told her I was going to follow his footsteps, which I did. I was not as strong as my grandfather, so I took the train and I hired cars to take me along his route. When I started, I thought it would take 2 years. You know, I quit my job as a magazine writer in New York and moved back to Los Angeles in order to tell my grandfather's story. But once I started looking into my grandfather's story and researching, and so many of the primary resources were in other languages, you know, six languages, from Ottoman Turkish to Armenian to French to German. So it took a long time to kind of not only go through the materials that I amassed, but also to search for other missing documents. One of the accounts that I found after many years of research was in that massacre, when I explained to you a little earlier about my grandfather being in that caravan and almost everyone else was slaughtered right after he escaped, I found the account of another man who survived that massacre. And my grandfather had written down his name, and I knew that he survived. He survived the genocide. So I spent years trying to see if he ever wrote anything about that night, and it was just this deep instinct that he did. And I finally found his account in Romania, written in an Armenian newspaper in 1924, and another account in 1940. And it just dovetailed exactly with my grandfather about what happened that night. So that's why, that's part of the reason why it took me so long. I became absolutely obsessed with my grandfather's story and trying to expand it through other sources as much as I could.
That's really astonishing, Dawn. I have to ask, did you fear for your life, given that journalist Hrant Dink was murdered in Istanbul just a few months before you traveled to Turkey in 2007?
I didn't fear for my life. It was the climate. It was kind of a climate of fear for a lot of Armenians at the time. They had this law at the time that you could not insult Turkishness.
Right.
And a lot of writers were being prosecuted under that, including Orhan Pamuk, the novelist. So I was afraid that, you know, have since changed that. And, you know, part of it also was just the stories that my family had told me. I mean, my mom was very nervous about me going there. And you know, I think for a lot of Armenian families, going to Turkey maybe for the first time is an emotional experience, because when I arrived in Istanbul for the first time, I was just overwhelmed by the beauty of this city. It's an incredible city. And then it hit me, you know, my family did not want to leave here. My family did not want to leave. This was their home. And, you know, if you think about the refugee crisis today and Syrian refugees, and I think people miss the point, or they forget, or they don't think about that many of these people don't want to leave their home. Like my family did not want to leave. They did not want to leave Turkey. They did not want to have to start a new life and lose everything, lose their home, lose their livelihood, learn a new language, and start over again. But they were lucky that they were able to.
We're speaking with the author of The 100-Year Walk, An Armenian Odyssey, Dawn McKean, third-generation Armenian American citizen now, wrote this wonderful book. The Turks still refuse to take responsibility for the Armenian genocide. They say, as you point out, the Armenians staged an uprising and sided with the Russian enemy during a time of war, and that their deaths were an unfortunate consequence of that. And I think that that's the attitude that the Turks had when you were over there, you know, knowing that they were hostile like that. I can certainly understand your fears. The Armenians were demonized by the Turks before the genocide. Like the Jews in Germany or the Jews in Eastern Europe or under Hitler, Armenians were demonized as a threat to society. Today in America, it's the Mexicans and the Muslims and the Arabs who are demonized. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I always think of this one quote that one of the architects of the Armenian genocide said in 1915 to a German journalist. He said, "We have been reproached for making no distinction between the innocent Armenians and the guilty. But that was utterly impossible in view of the fact that those who were innocent today might be guilty tomorrow." You had this policy in you know, 1915 to deport the majority of the Armenians from their homes and to drive them out into the desert and other places, and more than half of them died as a result. So obviously, there are terrorists today, but what's happening is that the whole Muslim population is being blamed for the actions of a few. And it's just heartbreaking to see this happen again. When I followed my grandfather's footsteps from Turkey into Syria before the Syrian civil war, I found the family of that Muslim Arab sheikh who saved my grandfather's life. And it was this incredible experience to find them, and I returned to visit them again in 2009. And now some of the rescuers of my family are now refugees. You see how cyclical it is to demonize a group of people. 100 years ago it was my Christian grandfather, and now it's from the very family who saved my grandfather's life.
Dawn, I was struck by something that you've mentioned about your grandfather being a sad man. I know that my grandparents came over. My grandmother escaped after seeing her family slaughtered and was a mail order bride, and they weren't very happy, obviously. Does that make sense to you in the context of what you've experienced?
Yes. I think, you know, for many survivors, you know, they reacted in different ways. Either they spoke about it, you know, like my grandfather, but what I've also learned is that so many of them never spoke about it, and they were so busy trying to survive the aftermath of the genocide, you know, trying to start their lives anew and, you know, raise their families and learn a new language. And I cannot believe, I mean, when I think about it, what that generation went through. And as much as it's a tragic story, I also find it incredibly inspiring. And I see this population of people, they're absolutely decimated. And they rose up again and stood up and, you know, they immigrated and, you know, and my family and like yours, you know, to be able to come to the United States to kind of finally live in peace. It's just, it's an incredible story. And I think that the subsequent generations have so much to be grateful to our grandparents and great-grandparents for what they endured.
Dawn, what are your thoughts on the U.S. not formally acknowledging the genocide?
I wish that the United States government would acknowledge what happened in 1915.
Hitler famously said, and this is a quote that you use in your book, "Kill without pity or mercy. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians?" This must have been a central concern of yours in writing the book, no?
Absolutely, absolutely. He said that before the Holocaust. If you don't acknowledge and learn from what happens when a whole population is decimated and wiped out, it'll just continue to repeat. And we've seen this happen. You see that the perpetrators of the Armenian Genocide were not brought to justice after World War One, and then you see Hitler seeing that the perpetrators of the genocide got away with it.
Last year was the centennial of the massacre and genocide, and I think many of us thought that finally the U.S. might formally acknowledge it, but perhaps in time that will happen. Dawn, I wanted to ask, what are you working on now?
The paperback just came out, and so I've been very involved with that, and I'm traveling to Armenia to speak about the book, and I've just been, because of my own experience with the Syrian family and, you know, watching what some of them are enduring as they've become refugees in Europe and elsewhere, I've just become completely focused on that, you know, and with writing articles and freelancing again.
Are you speaking any Armenian? Have you studied it?
I took night classes to try to learn Armenian. It's really difficult.
You beat. My family's Hungarian. That's even harder.
Well, Armenian has its own alphabet.
Perhaps one day I'll be able to say
Dawn,
better greeting.
How can listeners learn more about you as well as this wonderful book?
Sure. I have a website. It's dawnmackeen.com, and there's all links to different articles that I've written and more about the book and the rest of my work.
Great. And is there a link to speaking engagements in case you're in the New York area?
Oh, yes. Yes, there is. And I update the events page as well. So
wonderful.
Thank you.
Dawn, it's been a real pleasure. I just admire your tenacity and the detailed research that took so long and resulted in this wonderful chronicle.
The 100-Year Walk, an Armenian Odyssey by Dawn Mackeen.
Best of luck to you, and we hope to hear you soon in the New York area.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dawn.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
At the request of its member states, the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia commissioned a report on Israeli practices towards the Palestinian people and the question of apartheid. Apartheid is a crime against humanity under international law. The report found Israel in violation of three international laws, one of them, the 1998 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, states that the crime of apartheid means inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. The commission report concluded that Israel operates an apartheid regime against Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinian refugees and exiles. The commission made recommendations to dismantle the apartheid regime. In response, Israel and its ally, the United States of America, had the report rejected and caused the resignation of the head of the commission. We speak today with two apartheid activists. Both have just returned from an important conference on Israel held at the University of Cork in Cork, Ireland. The conference had twice been prevented by pro-Israeli forces. Richard Falk is the former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, and Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. Our second guest is Joel Covell, a former professor at Bard College and the author of the book Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Richard Falk is talking to us on the telephone from California. Joel Covell is here in the studio. Gentlemen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
And I'm very happy to be here.
Joel, the Cork Conference held last month in Ireland at the University of Cork was called International Law and the State of Israel, Legitimacy, Responsibility, and Exceptionalism. We understand it was quite successful. What were the obstacles in organizing this conference?
Well, I would also say that it was very heroic to have this conference on. The people involved, particularly Professor Oren Ben-Dor, Israeli born and works at the University of Southampton in the UK as a philosopher of law, which he is, wanted to put this out even in 2014, and looked all right at first, and then they came down on it. You know, they came down, how, you know, we can't do something like this. It was a clear example of the sort of suppression that we've become all too acquainted with about the subject, and this was then doubled the next year. They tried once more and got the same response, you know, compressing this narrative. It's a testimony to their persistence and their courage in doing it. And then they turned to Ireland, which is basically a liberated zone. You know, I was thinking during this course of this conference that Ireland is the world's leading producer of really nice people. It just turns out wonderful people. Now, I hate to be sort of ethnocentric, but you've got to love them. And they said, of course we'll do it. And they're definitely open to that sort of thing, and they're courageous, and I can itemize the people and how they did it, but they got behind the wheel, and it all went very, very well.
Richard, as it turned out, the timing of the conference in Ireland was fortuitous because the United Nations report that you, Richard, and Virginia Tully co-authored, titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People on the Question of Apartheid and Its Fate, had come out and had been suppressed, and then this conference came. Please talk about that.
Well, you're quite right that there was this strange coincidence that the UN report was released just days before the Cork conference, and because Ambassador Haley attacked me and the report in a very vicious kind of way, without having read it, of course, and that led the UN Secretary General to remove the report from the Esquire website, that was a sponsoring group in the Middle East, and that in turn led the director of Esquire to resign on principle. And all of that created a much greater attention for the report than would have occurred had it been just treated as one more UN report. It was quite relevant to the Cork Conference because the focus was on whether Israeli practices should be viewed through the prism of the crime of apartheid. And the Cork Conference not only shared this general sentiment, but agreed that it was a much more fruitful way to look at the problems facing the Palestinian people than the earlier emphasis on ending the occupation. It's a shift from territory to people as the essence of what needs to be done to create a sustainable peace for both peoples.
Richard and Joel, why do you both believe that Israel is an apartheid state? Could you talk about this in relation to the Palestinians in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, in East Jerusalem, and in exile and refugees?
Well, of course, I can talk about it in very general terms. There are five different locations of Palestinians, and there's a distinction in each one, but there's a general thread that runs through this, namely they are all the people who were expelled by the force of arms and by the international collaboration of Zionism with empire. This is a story that's been very well mystified and denied, but also very well told, particularly by people like Ilan Pape, who was going to be at the conference but couldn't attend. The basic theme of that is something that I wrote about in a paper back in 2001, which I called Zionism's Bad Conscience, and the point was that Zionists making this conquest had a dual consciousness of being cheated out of their own history, having been persecuted through the ages, and being more righteous than others and being God's chosen people, etc., etc., all of which led them onward. But at the same time, they had to commit immense crimes in order to carry out this endeavor, which has been exceptionally and exceedingly long-lived and complex, and you can go on forever on it. But that's the essential point. You commit those crimes in order to get the land, and you have a self-image that you are the superior human being. I mean, in fact, at the very heights or depths of Israeli racism, you have the notion that they're the only actual human beings, that the non-Israelis, as said one of the rabbis, Rabbi Cook, are no more human beings than they are cattle, and that we're the only true human beings. Well, now, if you have that contradiction, you're then caught in many, many secondary traps and elaborations. So it goes on and on. You know, you have to falsify your history. It's amazing that Jewish universities in Israel usually have two history departments, the one for history in general and one for Jewish history. Can you imagine that sense of entitlement? And they don't even talk to each other. So that lends this character of falsification, which is logically racist, and indubitably such, which is the fate of every settler colonial society, of which Israel is the major instance in the present world.
In concrete terms, what kind of practices, what kind of setup have the Israelis done in Israel proper, in the territories and so on? How does this apartheid play out in real life?
Well, I think there's two things to say, and at the beginning of a response to that question, the first of which is that Israel has deliberately fragmented the Palestinian people into these different categories in order to weaken their resistance to this policy of domination. And the second is that each of them, in its own way, is connected to a structure of systematic discrimination that's based on racial identity as race is understood in the apartheid convention. So that's the beginning of it. Then in each of these categories, the failure, for instance, to honor refugees' right of return is a form of radical discrimination, considering that they've been situated there in some cases for 70 years, in other cases for 50 or somewhat less time. But that's one category, and the same applies to involuntary exiles. As far as the residents, Palestinian residents of Jerusalem are concerned, their possibility of living normal lives is constantly undermined by manipulating residency rules and requirements disallowing building permits and generally making Palestinian lives miserable. And in Israel itself, the Palestinian minority, although it has some citizenship rights, is radically discriminated against when it comes to nationality laws. They have no right of return whatsoever, even for family unification, and there are a whole series of constraints on land acquisition, on residency, and it is a situation that involves quite drastic forms of daily discrimination.
And what about the West Bank?
Well, the West Bank is the most obvious case. You have dual laws. The settlers are entitled to the full protection of Israeli constitutional provisions for the rule of law, while the Palestinians have for 50 years, if you can imagine it, been living under military administration with no rights whatsoever. So that, in that sense, it's the most obvious and standard case of systematic discrimination based on race.
Richard, everything you've just said suggests this to me, but why is apartheid a crime against humanity?
Well, it's listed in the Rome Statute that set up the International Criminal Court as a standalone crime against humanity in Article 7 of the statute, and it's deliberately taken away from its origins in South Africa. It was obviously inspired by that racist regime. But on the other hand, it's important to distinguish what apartheid, how apartheid functioned in South Africa and how it's functioning today, according to our assessment, in Israel. And one should take account of the fact that many Israelis internally, ever since 1967, including people like Ben-Gurion and Rabin, have themselves talked about apartheid emerging if we don't settle the problems of occupying the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, Joel, that leads me to the next question.
Right.
What kind of planning and construction could be created for a truly authentic peace process?
Right. Well, you have an extremely profound contradiction here, and that has to be the fulcrum around which efforts proceed. I do not rule out the presence of violent episodes in the process, because there have been in the past, and when you have a state such as Israel, and what it has done, for example, in serial assaults on Gaza over the last decade of an unspeakable nature, there's no doubt that that's also in the air, but it's not in the air now, and it's not in the air as a primary factor. What's in the air is the deconstruction of the central contradiction of the attempt to build a Jewish contradictory state. No, a Jewish democratic state. I could barely bring myself to say it. It's such a vicious oxymoron. How can a state be Jewish and democratic? If it's just for Jewish people, where's the democracy part? And so the battle of ideas is the forum. It's the ground upon which this extends. And it has to do with the solidarity with the others, with the displaced. It has to do with consistent chipping away at the ancillary but very, very powerful apparatus that Israel and the Zionist system has created to take control of incredibly heinous and itself profoundly contradictory sort over the systems of a so-called democracy, such as our own. No time in human history has there been occasion where a client state, which is small and weak ostensibly, rules its master the way Israel has taken over so much of not just the state, but also civil society, and also the universities, which is to say, and even the churches, and so on and so forth. They work overtime at that. They have endless funding, and that has to be the deconstructed and taken apart, which it can be and has been over the years. And in fact, there's been considerable progress made, which has successfully isolated some of the younger generation of Jewish people from their seniors, so to speak, in the Zionist movements. And that is itself then another point. Out of that also comes the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which I don't have time for right now, but hopefully we'll get into, because that is the leading sore in the, you know, I don't know what organ I want to put there for the Israeli system, but they can't tolerate it.
Joel, is there room on the land to ensure that the right of return for Palestinians in exile?
Yeah. Absolutely, yes. I was there in 2005 and talked to people who were very expert on this matter, and it's been studied over and over again. The operating principle of Zionism is to erase the history of the existence, even of the villages that they destroyed. But this is constantly being challenged. A wonderful man named Eitan Bornstein had an organization called Zakrot, which consists of going around and putting up street signs of what used to be, you know, Palestinian villages. And they did it, and reliably, Israeli garbage trucks would come by and take them out. But this is the nature of the struggle. It's a struggle for memory. It's a struggle for solidarity and so forth. And it's also a struggle for calculation and being very clear-minded. At this conference, there was a wonderful man. I think his name is Abu Sita. He was a civil engineer, Palestinian. And he detailed very, very explicitly and very elegantly just how possible it would be. In fact, he said that it would cost less than the U.S. Donations to Israel in 1 year to create good living conditions for everybody in that society, on all sides. Okay, and in fact, you wouldn't have to do it any more than 1 year, is against the U.S., which is constantly pouring endless dollars as well as weapons into the situation. So there's nothing stopping this real peace process, except for the Zionist system.
What are the limitations of international law with respect to the Israeli practices?
Well, they're massive because international law only works when it's reinforced by political will, and particularly when it is reinforced by geopolitical tendencies. And the opposite situation exists with respect to Israel, where Israel has fundamental impunity because it is shielded from accountability by the United States. And there's really not a significant difference, so far at any rate, between the way in which it was shielded during the Obama years and the way it is being protected now that Trump is president.
Joel and Richard, we just have a few minutes remaining, but on a personal note, we'd like to know why each one of you is so actively concerned with the issue of Israel and Palestine.
And I just want to add that our program will be broadcast on the morning of Passover, the Festival of Liberation.
Okay. Let's start with Joel.
Thank you. Well, I recently completed, and it's just about ready to be released, a memoir called The Lost Traveler's Dream, which is laid out in considerable detail along with other odd features in my life. I was born into a Brooklyn Jewish family, not very observant. I put up with living there. The worst thing that ever happened to me was, in that respect, was an aunt I loved very much died, and she had broken with the Jewish faith. And at her funeral, I overheard several other aunts cursing her for depriving them of a Jewish service. And I said, oh, this is really bad. And that kind of broke my inward tie. And then the outward tie takes place over very, very long, complex processes, but it starts after the 67 war, when I found myself terrified by what was going on, and then realizing, why am I frightened? This is something wrong here. And in investigating, it became clearer and clearer to me that it was a very devious and wrong-headed process going on, and I took not arms, but my mind against that, and spoke about it, and distanced myself from my parents and my family and from my jobs and so forth, and paid a price, but it was totally worth it, because to me there's nothing that can be greater to do than to struggle for justice, or as they say in the Bible, fight the good fight.
And Richard, your thoughts?
Well, my development of this involvement is less tied to my ethnic identity, although I am Jewish. I was really not brought up in any way that made it a very important dimension of my development, but my friendship with Edward Said was an important element, and then step by step I became involved, and to my surprise I was appointed UN Special Rapporteur for occupied Palestine for a period of 6 years, and that both brought me incredible defamatory attacks and made me much more aware of what was happening to the Palestinian people. And this tied in with my, long-term career interest in global justice and in being a critic of American foreign policy going back to the Vietnam period. I've been involved in a number of different contexts other than Israel-Palestine, such as South Africa, Iran, and Turkey, the Middle East generally, as well as some of the Asian issues arising in the Philippines and South Korea and so on. So it's really my most continuous professional engagement, and my, I suppose, identity as a activist is around these global justice issues and American foreign policy relationship to those issues.
Well, Richard Falk and Joel Covell, Heidi and I want to thank you very much. You're two beautiful people.
Yes.
And it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder.
I want to thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It was a good listening to Joel as well.
Yes, and Richard as well. A very heroic individual, I might say. And you two are fighting the good fight.
Well, thank you both. And onward.
Take it easy, Joel.
Okay.
Richard.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In a backlash to the 2008 Obama election victory, 2 years later in 2010, the Republican Party of Wisconsin won both houses of the legislature and the governorship. The Republicans then redrew the legislative map, making it impossible for the Democratic Party to capture a majority of the legislative seats at any time in the decade, no matter how many votes they got. This is called partisan gerrymandering, the process of drawing distorted legislative districts to undermine democracy. As a consequence, people in Wisconsin have had their great university system harmed, right-to-work laws have been enacted wrecking their unions, and there has been substantial environmental damage. We speak today with Professor William Bill Whitford, who recently retired as a law professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He's the lead plaintiff in a federal lawsuit against partisan gerrymandering. His case is likely to be heard in the Supreme Court. In the case captioned Whitford versus Gill, 12 Wisconsin voters are challenging the constitutionality of the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps. Heretofore, the Supreme Court has been unwilling to get involved. This case may change that and restore a measure of democracy to a broken system in Wisconsin and later elsewhere.
Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what is the meaning of partisan gerrymandering?
Partisan gerrymandering is distinguished from racial gerrymandering, a practice that used to exist but doesn't exist anymore, of creating districts that are wildly different in populations. in partisan gerrymandering, the intent, and of course very common, is the intent of the legislature is to disadvantage voters of a particular partisan persuasion. And in the case I'm involved in, that persuasion is Democrat.
In 1986, the Supreme Court said that litigants alleging redistricting abuse must prove, quote, both intentional discrimination against an identifiable political group and actual discriminatory effect on that group. No lawsuit of the kind you are bringing has yet to meet with success. Why do you think your case is different?
Well, the case you cite is a very important one because it's the first one in which the Supreme Court did hold that partisan gerrymandering, discrimination on the basis of partisan persuasion, could be a constitutional violation. But as you note, they said that had to meet a couple standards. The partisan intent standard has never been very hard to meet, but the partisan effect standard has been hard to meet, and has been hard to meet because the court has demanded a couple of things. It's accepted that some partisan effect of a legislative redistricting is inevitable as long as we assign the job to legislatures that have partisan motives. So there was a need to distinguish kind of excessive partisan gerrymandering from normal partisan gerrymandering. And secondly, the court was concerned to have evidence that the partisan bias would be enduring. It wasn't just a one election kind of phenomenon. Basically, I think the political scientists have been slow in coming up with the kinds of algorithms or analytical methods would allow us to show in a kind of convincing way that the partisan gerrymander is more extreme than most of them and enduring, not just a one-election phenomenon. Now, in our case, the political scientists have finally stepped up, and we've there are a couple or three different tests out there that can be used. We've adopted one called the efficiency gap, but they all show that Wisconsin in 2011 adopted an apportionment that is one of the most extreme in the modern era. And all the different political science metrics, I call them, for showing how extreme a gerrymander is, line up on that score. They're all relatively consistent.
You said that there's an even-handed way to measure gerrymandering. In your case, the standard you called the efficiency gap. The art of gerrymandering is the art of wasting the other side's votes as efficiently as you can. Your lawsuit refers to this efficiency gap. What is it, and what is what you call packing and cracking?
Let me start with packing and cracking, Michael. Packing is they're the essential techniques of a partisan gerrymandering. Packing is the practice of assigning the voters of the disadvantaged party, in Wisconsin, the Democrats, into districts which are highly Democratic, 70% and over. And cracking is the practice of taking the remaining Democrats, ones that are not assigned to a PAC district, and being sure they're no more than about 40, spreading them out so they're no more than about a 45% in any one district. The kind of earmark or the sign of a partisan gerrymander is that the disadvantaged party has many more districts that are, we'll say, two-thirds and more Democratic predictably based on past election behavior, and the favored party has more districts that are in the 55 to 60% range. And the efficiency gap refers to the fact that by packing and cracking, the favored party uses their votes more efficiently. That's where the term comes. By getting wins that are safe, you don't want, because you want the partisan gerrymander to be enduring, you don't want a lot of swing districts, but safe, but not to the same extent as a PAC district. The technical definition of efficiency gap has to do with what's called wasted votes. Wasted votes are all votes in any district, are all votes for the losing candidate and all votes for the winning candidate that exceed 50% plus one. As you can see, in a PAC district, the Democrats in Wisconsin have a lot of wasted votes because they win by two-thirds and more. So everything above 50% are wasted votes. The Republicans don't have that many wasted votes. I mean, all their votes are wasted because they're for the losing candidate, but there aren't very many Republican votes in those districts. In the crack districts, the Democrats have a lot of wasted votes because all the votes for the losing candidate are wasted, and the Democrats will have, we'll say, 40 to 45% of the vote. Republicans don't have very many wasted votes because they win with, say, 55 to 60% of the vote, but they needed 50% to win, so only the extra is wasted. So the metric basically looks at the fact that one party has many more wasted votes than the other, and the more extreme that difference, the higher the efficiency gap or the more partisan the gerrymander.
Thank you for that. Bill, how did the Whitford versus Gill case start, and what role did you play in it?
Mm-hmm. There was a group that began meeting after the 2012 election. The 2012 election was a real wake-up call here because Wisconsin's kind of a 50-50 state or a purple state, as we say, but 2012 was a very good election year. For the Democrats, Obama won big as any Democratic candidate for president has ever won in the state in modern history. And Tammy Baldwin got elected to the Senate. And if you totaled up all the votes for the state assembly, there's 99 seats in the state assembly. The Democrats had, I'll say, 52% of the statewide vote. But we won only 39 out of 99 seats. Now, how could you get 52% of the state vote, but only 39 of the 99 seats? Well, that's the packing and cracking. That's the partisan gerrymander. So a bunch of people led by a Democratic state assemblyman, an old friend of mine, began meeting in Milwaukee to basically ask what could be done, and they invited me to join because this assemblyman was an old friend of mine and I was about to retire. And although I'm not a constitutional law expert, I'm a political junkie from adolescence. We began meeting, began to figure out, based on that 86 case you referred and some other things, that maybe we could bring a lawsuit, trying to be the first case ever to establish that we had an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander and that we thought we had a very good fact situation, and the 2012 election results were pretty good proof. So we began looking around for free lawyers because we thought we had a good fact situation but not much money. And basically, we stumbled into a group of lawyers who really served us very well. Some of them are Wisconsin trial attorneys who we knew about. And then we stumbled on to a young Chicago law professor named Nicholas Stephanopoulos, who is one of the kind of creators of this efficiency gap metric, along with a political scientist friend of his. And he agreed to come onto the case as one of the attorneys, and that's how the case got started.
Bill, I wanted to ask you about the effects of partisan gerrymandering on the people of the state of Wisconsin. I grew up there. We always referred to it as the great state of Wisconsin, and we did so because of the unions, the kind of environmental protection we had, the wonderful University of Wisconsin, and all of that has been effective. In fact, a mutual friend of ours, Steve Bourne, knows a fellow, Dan Kaufman, who's writing a book entitled The Tragedy of Wisconsin. And I know that's what concerned you when you thought about launching into this litigation. But could you tell me what's happened to that state in the wake of the Scott Walker governorship and what they've done there?
Yeah. Well, lots of things have happened. The key election was 2010, where the Republicans, it was a big landslide, as you know, a Republican landslide across the country, but the Republicans swept everything here. And they came in with a very aggressive agenda. Part of that aggressive agenda was, of course, this apportionment, which I mentioned is about the most partisan gerrymander in modern history. But they also pretty much killed the public unions, which produced a lot of demonstrations in the state and a series of recall elections, which a lot of people know about. But they've done a lot. They've kept on and done a lot of other things. They've substantially underfunded both K through 12 education and the state university system. And had, I think, probably long-term effects on the university. It's still, I think, a great university, but not as great as it was and is slipping slowly. Other kinds of effects they've had very considerable environmental effects. They have passed right-to-work legislation, which is inhibiting private unions, having killed public unions. So the union movement is substantially diminished. They've cut taxes on the wealthy a great deal, underfunded all kinds of infrastructure. Wisconsin has gone from, in a very short time, from a state that had one of the best highway systems, road systems in the country, to one of the, five or ten worst. I don't know exactly what the statistic is.
How does this fit in with the financing of the elections? If you follow the dollar, can you say that the Koch brothers are there, or their organizations,
conservative
organizations?
Yes, they're here big time. The Koch brothers invested very early in Scott Walker, and from their point of view, very successfully.
Yeah, I'll say. Let's not end on a pessimistic point, Bill. The case looks like it may get to the Supreme Court. You think that'll happen, and what do you think might happen in the Supreme Court?
Well, I put our odds at 50-50, better or not, when we were doing our research back before we got our lawyers, and our lawyers agree with this analysis. Scalia was still alive, so the Gorsuch nomination is not critical. We'd be better with Garland, but we think we can still win Gorsuch. The case is designed to get Kennedy's vote based on his opinions in a couple earlier cases. We think the efficiency gap will appeal to him. The case will almost certainly get to the Supreme Court. It'll be argued in the next term, which begins in October 2017. We need a court order from the Supreme Court saying that they'll hear the case, but it's almost certain to come. Both sides expect it. Both sides are lawyering up. Amici are lining up to file amicus curiae briefs on both sides. So we're cautiously optimistic that we'll get a leading Supreme Court precedent, which will, if we do, unleash a whole bunch of lawsuits all across the country, because all Wisconsin might be the worst of the worst. There are a lot of partisan gerrymanders out there. Some of them are Democratic gerrymanders, by the way.
Yeah, no, I know.
They're not all Republican gerrymanders.
I know. Pardon? North Carolina. Anyway, Bill, we're running out of time. I just wanted to thank you and ask you to promise to check back in with us, anticipating a victory once you get to the Supreme Court. It's been a pleasure to have you. Bill Whitford, Professor Emeritus from the University of Wisconsin Law School, my alma mater. Bill, you take it easy. Heidi, the exorcism of Titan Point is coming up this Saturday, April 15th at noon in downtown Manhattan at 33 Thomas Street.
Michael, what's Titan Point?
Well, it's one of the major spying operations that the NSA runs in North America. It's a 55-story skyscraper with no windows, really creepy. And inside, the NSA has its machines hooked up to AT&T machines. We always thought it was an AT&T
right.
building. It's not.
Right.
In line with the exorcism of the Pentagon in 1967, there's a group of artists and musicians in New York City that are exorcising the demons out of the NSA building in downtown Manhattan. It's at noon, Saturday, April 15th, 33 Thomas Street. You can get a hold of their website if you want. It's called editor@thequietamericanreview.org for further details. Anyway, I'll be there, and I'm looking forward to seeing you there. 55-story skyscraper, no windows.
Sounds scary to me, Michael. Will there be any flying beds?
Well, there's going to be a perimeter of salt laid around the building. Mm. There's going to be a sacrifice of an ostrich egg and other mystical means to extract the data. So I hope that a lot of people come down there for this. This is the kind of humor, I think, that we need in the days of Donald Trump.